Hi, and welcome to the Rare Business Podcast. My name is Adrian Swinsko, and I'm a consultant, advisor, researcher, and writer on all things related to customer service and customer experience. Through this podcast, I seek out and interview CEOs, entrepreneurs, business and tech leaders, and leading thinkers about what it takes to build organizations that produce better outcomes for both customers and employees in this fast-moving modern age that we live in. If this is your first time listening to one of these interviews, then welcome. And please do dive into the archives at adrianswinsko.com, as I've now completed over 250 of these interviews in the last few years. If this is not your first time listening, then thank you for returning, and I'll aim to do a good enough job to keep you coming back week after week. Anyway, that's enough from me right now. Let's get into the interview. So, welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, I have Richard Schotten, who is part-time Head of Behavioral Science at Manning Gottlieb OMD, but also, more importantly, I think, author of a new book called The Choice Factory, 25 Behavioral Biases That Influence What We Buy. Hi, Richard. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Adrian. Good to speak to you.
So, Richard, that was a bit of an elaborate introduction.
Yeah.
Perhaps for the benefit of our listeners and readers, perhaps you can color that in a little bit and tell us a bit about you and a bit about the work that you do.
Well, last 15 or 20 years or so, I've worked in a variety of media agencies, so advising companies on their advertising. Mm-hmm. And over that time, probably from around 2004-ish, I've become interested in behavioral science or social psychology. And my speciality has become, how do you apply findings from that field to marketing? And marketing in its broadest sense.
Right.
So whether that's creative, pricing, media placement, targeting, any of those areas, I believe that there are interesting findings from the field of behavioral science that can be applied. And that's my main focus. And alongside that, I run a lot of experiments to try and bridge the gap between academic findings and then very practical outputs.
Perfect. Now, So and the product of all of that, I guess, is the book.
Yes, yeah.
And The Choice Factory. So tell us about the book. Tell us about who's it, you know, what it does, who's it for, how it came about. I mean, did you came up with a, you just build a whole binder of notes and then you decided, oh, I should turn that into a book? Or kind of what's the main sort of thrust of it and who's it for?
So the main thrust is there's 25 chapters and it follows a single person through a day.
Right.
And there's a little bit at the beginning of the chapter following this person, and they have to make 25 decisions. So should they have red wine or white wine? Should they give money to a beggar or not? Should they hire someone at an interview?
Right.
And then each chapter then follows the same format. So a little bit on what is the evidence from psychology or behavioral science that explains why they made that decision. So what's the bias that may have explained that decision? Mm-hmm. So that could be anchoring or the pratfall effect or Goodhart's law. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I talk a little bit longer about the experiments that I've done that show these academic experiments work in the real world, they work commercially, and they work today. And then the main bit, and this is, I think, where it hopefully differentiates from other popular psychology books, is, well, look, now you know about this bias, the main thing is, well, what can you do with that? How can you change your pricing, or how can you change your messaging or your customer experience to take advantage of that, of that psychological finding?
So, I mean, you picked 25 biases and things, and I was just thinking, so what does that mean? You know, it's a bit like, I wrote a book. It came out in 2016, and it was 68 ways, blah blah blah. Yep. And somebody asked me the other day, kind of, what was it? You know, what's the divination around sort of 68, as it were? I said, well, I was rather hoping it was going to be 69, just for fun.
Yeah.
But actually, in truth, I said it started out around about 84, and then I looked at all these different sort of things, and then they sometimes didn't stand scrutiny, and therefore they got eliminated, therefore got whittled down to 68 that I thought were there. So tell us about the 25. I mean, is this list exhaustive? Is this all the things that they are, or kind of why 25?
So, great question. So definitely not exhaustive. So recently I've been going around saying, oh, there's 100, 150 odd biases, but I've never actually gone and done an exhaustive count. But yesterday, and I went to Wikipedia, so it's not exactly authoritative, but it's one of the best places to get, not the academic papers behind them. There's other sources for that. Mm-hmm. But just as a long list, there's a huge list of cognitive bias. I went through those and I found there are 192 listed there. And I'm sure if you pushed there'd be a few more. So what I wanted to do was not have every single bias in a very brief amount. I wanted to pick the biases that I thought were most relevant for brands and commercial organizations.
Right.
And I wanted to... I essentially thought, roughly go for 20 or 30. Mm-hmm. Now, what I wish I'd done is stuck to my original idea. I think I got 23 biases, and the publisher said, you shouldn't have an uneven number. You should kind of round it up to 25. So I did. And actually,
technically, that's not an even number.
So, yes. Okay. what would it be? I don't know.
A rounded number, let's say.
Yes, yeah. I'm not even sure if that's the right term, but yeah, you know what I mean. But about a week after finishing the book, I read this wonderful paper by, and I'm awful at the pronunciation, Januszewski and UYS,
right?
Two University of Florida professors of psychology and marketing. And what they showed was some of the power of having a very specific number, a precise number. So 23 or 27, not 20 or 25.
Ah.
And their main thrust was, look, this is to do with pricing. And their argument was brands should have precise prices, not round prices, because consumers assume round prices have been marked up more. That they know every brand marks up its prices. And if it's been given in a round number, the consumer uses kind of big units to jump down to what they think is the actual price or the real price or the kind of real value.
Right.
If price is in a very precise number, then they use much smaller increments.
Ah.
And I think like all good psychologists, they start off with a hypothesis, then they test it in the lab just with surveys and questioning. But what was really good about this study was they took it into the real world. So they looked at a huge data bank of house prices in the US, and they found that people who listed their house at a precise number, say $501,000, mm-hmm. got close to the asking price than those who listed it at a round price, say $500,000. So if people take nothing else from this podcast today, they next list their house, that's at least something practical they've learned. But one of the arguments of the psychologist was that, if you have a round number, people think, well, the round number came first and you just filled, you then worked to that round number. If you have a precise number, people think it's in our case, the number of biases that came first, and it gives them more credibility.
Ah, so my number 68 may actually be working for me.
Yes. May want to ignore everything. If I can't even get the right bloody title of the book, you may want to ignore everything I say. But I think for the next book, it'll be 23 or 26 behavioral biases that influence what you buy.
So I wonder, I know there's some people that have written books that have gone something like 9.5 or 12.5 things. And I wonder what the impact of that is. Do people just look at that and just go, that's just kind of half-baked or what?
Do you know, I really like it. I mean, I would think, I've never seen it, this is now moving to speculation, I've never seen any evidence, but I think that the point of the Florida professors would be that would make it feel as if the biases came first and you chose the best ones, not you force-fit it to a round number. So, and the other bit, I suppose you could argue, is it would be distinctive. Everything else in life is... Well, a non-fractional number, so it would stand out.
Wow. Okay. So let's kind of backtrack a little bit, and let's actually let me ask you about kind of like just the biases themselves, and actually why should we be paying attention to these biases? Because some people might kind of go like, yada yada yada, whatever. It's like, what's the fundamental reason why we should be paying attention to this stuff when it comes to advertising, marketing, service experience, all that type of stuff? Because I guess that sets us up for, this is important and here's why.
Yeah. Okay, so it comes down to, if you are dealing with people, mm-hmm. surely the study of how people make decisions is a powerful thing. I mean, I think that is at the heart of it, that this is pretty much as relevant a topic as it can get for marketers and or business owners in the broader sense. That essentially everything we're trying to do as brand owners or marketers is to change behavior. You know, you're trying to get people to pay more. You're trying to get people to switch from a competitive brand to buy your product more regularly. Mm-hmm. All of that is behavior change. So why would you not draw on the 120-year history of academic experiments that give you some evidence into why people do these things?
Yeah,
I think relevance is the big thing. Right. But then second to that, there's, and I think there's three big reasons. So relevance is the most important thing. The second is probably robustness.
Right.
There's still a lot of decisions, I think, in business that are made on the based on the opinion of the highest paid person in the room,
right?
Which is obviously suboptimal. Mm-hmm. Far better to base your decisions on the peer-reviewed evidence of some of the most respected scientists from around the world, whether that's, you know, Kahneman and Thaler operating now, or more historic figures like B.F. Skinner and Elliot Aronson.
Yeah.
So second, the big one, I think, is that robustness. And then the third, which I like, and it can be, sometimes we'll use this as a weakness of behavioral science, but I actually think it's a strength. And that's the third R, which is the range.
Right.
That there is a bit of a dangerous tendency, I think, in marketing at the moment, to try and come up with an uber theory that explains everything.
Right.
So we've got these ideas like brand purpose that people try and apply in every single circumstance.
Yes.
And the danger with that is, if you think about the sheer breadth of businesses out there, from coffee shops to car makers, beer brands to cigarette manufacturers. I mean, everyone has very different cigarette manufacturers. Bad example, they can't market, but everyone has very, very different, challenges. So the danger is, if you have this one way of thinking, mm-hmm. you end up force fitting your problem to the tool at hand.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the kind of the one thing is that there's, it's also an indictment on many professions, in that yes. when people are looking for that one size fits all, or the answer, as it were, then what it does is it just basically says that they're being lazy in their thinking, because, or they don't actually have a proper grasp of what's actually going on in their own business or with their own customers or clients or consumers. I think
you're absolutely right. I think it says more about the individual motivations of the marketer or the employee than what is necessary for that business. If there's one thing, people are feeling more time pressure than ever. So they jump with joy when someone says there is a single thing you have to learn and it will be useful in all circumstances. The problem is, it sounds nice, but it's misleading. You know, life is messy. And I, the reason I love behavioral science is, there are, as we've talked earlier, hundreds of biases. It's now incumbent on the marketer or the business owner to choose whichever bias is relevant to their particular problem. That's that's, I think, sometimes the skill in it.
Absolutely. So it's almost like having a range of keys on a big ring, and then you kind of go around and you figure out, well, what's the key that unpicks that lock, as it were.
Yes, a lovely analogy. Absolutely.
Perfect. So I know that you've written this book because it's almost like a written for your peers in many ways. This book is like targeted primarily at those in the advertising marketing kind of fields, because, you know, and these activities, you know, they obviously influence a customer's overall experience. But I mean, are these biases more broadly relevant for other professionals, like those people that are in the service experience, loyalty, engagement, sort of retention sort of mm-hmm. domains as well?
Oh, absolutely. You know, going back to the point of, if you are dealing with people, right. surely you want to know what makes people tick. And the great bit about social psychology and behavioral science is it helps explain why people make the decisions they do. Mm. And often it comes up with different explanations than people might claim. As one of the underlying themes of behavioral science is, be very suspicious, not as far as cynical, but be at least skeptical about claim data, because what people say motivates them and what actually motivates them is quite a different thing. There's a wonderful old advertiser from 40, 50 years ago, David Ogilvy, who said, consumers don't think how they feel, say what they think, or do what they say. And I think that sums up pretty nicely the problems with claim data.
Perfect. I mean, so you've actually kind of produce a really nice segue into kind of what I was going to ask you to go next. So the check's in the post for that. Thank you very much. Because I was going to ask you to just help us kind of talk about some of the biases that are in the book, and I picked out a few just to give people a flavor of it, so we don't actually kind of tell them everything that's in the book, because that's not the point of this. But let's go back to that because it's listed as bias number 7, and you've mentioned claim data there. I mean, let's step back and let's maybe kind of like revisit that. It's like, tell us about this bias, was it like the danger of claimed data, and what does that actually kind of mean, and what are the implications of it?
So that danger of claimed data essentially means that you can be misled if you take what people say they do at face value.
Right.
And that's a bit of an issue because billions of pounds globally are spent on market research, which involves focus groups or surveys. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying that is wasted money, and there's a lot of value in those, but they have to be interpreted properly. And if you're not in the kind of skilled hands of a moderator or good quant researcher, mm-hmm. then it can take you down the wrong path.
Right.
One of the experiments that kind of shows that quite nicely in the book is there's a University of Leicester psychologist called Adrian North.
Right.
And he ran this wonderful experiment with a supermarket where he persuaded, and I think his persuasive skills have to be admired, he persuaded the supermarket to alternate the music they played in the wine aisle.
Right.
So one period, one week, whatever, they'd play German music, and the next week they'd play French music.
Right.
And what he did was monitor the proportion of sales, just looking at French and German wines, and looked at how those were affected by the music being played.
Right.
So when French music's been played, I think it was 77-odd% of the French or German wine was French. But when the German music was playing, it switched the other way around, and about 73% of the wine was German.
Right.
Now, why this is interesting is, as people were leaving, North stopped people who'd bought wine and said to them, look, why did you buy the wine that you did? And only 2% of people mentioned spontaneously the music.
Right.
And then when he started probing them, you know, prompting them, well, look, was it the music? 86% denied flat out the music had any effect on them. Now, what's fascinating here is you can see from the observation of, you know, this week on, week off change of music, the music was having an effect, mm-hmm. but no one would admit it. Now, it's not that those consumers were lying, and, you know, that sometimes is a problem with surveys on very sensitive matters, but it's not that they were necessarily lying, it's that they were what psychologists call confabulating. They didn't really know why they'd bought it, so they invented plausible rational reasons.
Right.
And the danger of those plausible rational reasons is often things like, oh, it was on offer, or it was cheap, or I was cooking French food tonight. That if you listen to those reasons as a business owner, you might end up focusing on different levers than what actually influences people.
So actually, I mean, is there to counter that? I mean, I know there's kind of things around sort of research tools and techniques you can do to try and sort of unpick all of that. But is there also then an argument when you're thinking about that sort of the danger of claim data to almost add in an element of observation as well? So you actually can see the whole thing rather than just being asking people for their opinion. So actually observation may actually tell you just as much, if not more, than asking people their opinion.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's not a case, as you say, it's not like stop doing surveys, stop doing focus groups. It's firstly, just make sure you see that as data to be interpreted.
Sure.
Secondly, there's some techniques within survey writing that you can use. So actually ask a very large sample a question, and then within that sample, you ask different groups who are similar groups the question in very slightly different ways, and that can often tease out genuine answers. So you kind of approach the problem a bit obliquely. Or, as you say, there are completely different sources of data, like observing people in those type of experiments, or newer data sources like analysing what people are searching for. That's another fascinating insight into what people actually think.
Yeah, perfect. Mm. So let's kind of move on to another kind of bias and the one I wanted to pick was bias number 11, which is expectancy theory.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And so tell us about that, Richard, and tell us about kind of why, what that tells us and what we should be doing about it.
Oh, so that's a fascinating one, which is essentially the idea, and a lot of the experiments here around food, I think it you know, people can, it's easier to kind of grasp if you think about it as food, but it's the idea that when we taste something, the our enjoyment of it is not just created by the physical and the nature of what we eat. It's not just created by the chemicals and the texture of the food.
Yeah.
It's also partly what we expect to experience. Now, that isn't speculation. There is a psychologist who's pretty much dedicated, his whole focus, Cornell psychologist called Brian Wansink, just studies food psychology.
Right.
And he has done a lot of experiments around showing that, you know, if the price of a food will make a difference to how people taste it, the more expensive it is. You know, if you lie to people and tell them it's an expensive wine, it will taste nicer. The same wine will taste nicer than if you lie to them and tell them it's a cheap wine.
Right.
The adjectives that you use to describe a food can improve the actual taste. He's even shown in an experiment that the how you serve food will change the taste. So a simple experiment creates a batch of brownies. Sometimes he serves them to people on napkins, sometimes paper plates, sometimes china plates.
Right.
And even though it's the same batch of brownies, when people have received the brownie on a paper plate, they rate it quite low in terms of taste, a little bit higher. Sorry, napkin low, paper plate a bit higher, china plate even higher. And the same is true for the amount they're prepared to pay for that brownie.
Wow.
So it's an interesting area here around, well, look, there are two ways of adding value to your product, and this is where we move beyond food. You can either change the actual nature of the thing that you're selling, or you can change how it is referred to, displayed, and how people expect it's going to taste. And it opens up a huge new range of tactics and techniques for the marketer and business owner.
And so, would that be this? So, let me get this right. Mm. So, if I said, if we served the world's best food to people in sat in a shack versus mediocre food served in a fabulous setting overlooking a sunlit sort of like bay or kind of, you know, and a beautiful island somewhere, the actually people will probably rate the mediocre food much, much higher because of the environment that they're in as well.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't go as far as saying, I don't want to say that the actual food itself is completely immaterial.
Right.
But what I'd be confident of is the ratings of that food would depend on exactly as you say, the surroundings, the way it was served, the way it's described on the menu.
Right.
Those external elements will have an effect. And what's interesting for businesses is, you know, you always get this kind of division of, well, you can have engineering solutions in which you actually change the physical product, or you have psychology solutions. Mm. You know, you change how you describe it on the menu.
Sure.
And what's interesting, I'm not saying you should do one to the exclusion of the other, but why you should explore the psychological solutions first is that they are generally a lot cheaper.
Yeah, I think this is, it's fascinating. I use an example around, particularly, you know, again, a food example, because, and particularly restaurants, because it's something that most people are familiar with.
Yeah.
And I say to people, imagine if you go to a restaurant and it's a place you've been looking forward to for a while, and you've kind of heard good things about it, and you go in there, and the atmosphere and ambience is great, and the service is great, and you get all the food's all served, and it smells and kind of tastes kind of wonderful, and blah blah, and you're having a great time, and then you excuse yourself and go to the bathroom.
Yeah, yeah.
And the bathroom's an absolute horror show.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, now what do you think of the food and the restaurant? And it's like everything changes.
Yes, yes, yeah. And because there's not a, you know, especially with taste, there's not a fixed way of interpreting things. You know, if you're drinking wine out of a bottle and it comes from some fancy vineyard and there's some kind of, I don't know if it's exact language, some harsh tastes, you might interpret that positively. Oh, this is a sign of its richness. And whereas if it comes from, a Nebraska vineyard, you interpret those same signals very differently. You probably think, oh, this is a symbol of it. This signifies it being cheaply knocked out.
Sure.
So it's that ambiguity that often is, I think, can be affected by those, that expectancy theory.
Perfect. So let's kind of talk another one. Let's do another two, and then we'll kind of because we could talk all day about this sort of stuff, I guess. So the next one I want to talk about is actually bias. The next one, which is bias 12, and that's overconfidence. And the thing I found particularly interesting about this in the bit in the book is particularly the Slovich experiment and that, you know, how that relates to marketeers and data, because I think that's particularly relevant. So tell us about that bias.
So overcomes the general idea that we generally think we are better than we actually are. So it's a area that's been shown again and again. Svensson, for example, showed that 88% of drivers think they're better than average. Patricia Cross showed that even psychology lecturers who know about the bloody bias of overconfidence, even 90% of them think they are better than average. Mm-hmm. And I've now, since the book, asked, I think, 1,600, 1,700 odd marketers whether they are better than their peers at their job. And I think the latest number is, I think 81% currently think they are better than average. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not just something to laugh at. It has some worrying implications. You know, the kind of areas you think here around, well, if we think we're better than we actually are, the danger is we don't spend enough on marketing. Mm-hmm. So we think we're so damn good, we're going to stand out with our amazing ideas and creativity. Mm-hmm. It often means that I think brands stop using a great piece of creative or great creative vehicle that's still well above average but in slow decline. Mm-hmm. They move away from it too early because they overestimate their ability to repeat that success. Mm-hmm. And then, as you say, there's some particular dangers about the arrival of huge volumes of data that Slovich has looked at. What Slovich did, he looked at worked with, I think it was handicap setters at horse races.
Right.
And he asked them to predict the results of races. And he gave them, I think there were up to 88 variables that could be useful. Some people he gave 5 bits of data, and others he went all the way up to 40 pieces of data, and lots of different numbers in between. And what he found was that getting more data had no positive effect on people's predictions.
Right.
Because often, you know, the inconsequential factors or kind of less strong data could actually pull people away from focusing on the important stuff.
Right.
So it didn't improve the prediction, but what it did do was increase people's confidence in their ability. So I think that is a problem we're facing in business generally at the moment.
And you know what that makes me think about? That makes me think about this whole thing about the debate that's going on around sort of personalization right now, and the personalization of the customer experience. And everybody's talking about big data and analytics and all that sort of like stuff. And then there's another school of thought, which is that says, actually, there is diminishing marginal returns to the amount of data that you collect. And actually, to deliver a really good personalized experience, you only need probably around 3, 4, 5 bits of data rather than hundreds of bits of data. Mm. It's just you have to think carefully about what is the data that you want, and therefore it's kind of completely that. So we actually think, oh, we've got all these databases and all these kind of this list and all this information, but actually you end up with this, as you say, suffering from this overconfidence bias, because you think the more that you've got, the better that you're doing. But in actual fact, the opposite can be true.
I mean absolutely. I think there's a few elements. There's the, as you say, don't just measure it because you can.
Yeah.
Once you start measuring, capturing data, you're capturing a particular metric, it's very hard then to ignore it. Mm. So if it's an irrelevant piece, it could have a kind of negative effect. It draws your attention away from other areas. Mm-hmm. I think there's the second problem we've got of we put too much emphasis on what's easy to measure and too little emphasis on what's hard to measure. So the problem we're having in marketing is what's easy to measure is often the short-term effect of advertising. Mm. So, clicks, views of an ad, immediate sales.
Yeah.
What's hard to measure is the longer-term effect of that advertising. Mm. And what we're seeing there is a kind of a race to the bottom where advertising becomes more and more focused on the short term, which looks brilliant for 6 months. You know, your cost per sale starts to improve. But then after 6 months, when your kind of brand attributes start to decline, then you start seeing some big problems.
Yeah, no, I don't know if this is a great description, but I always kind of like, you know, in a moment when I'm having a bit of a rant about some things, kind of feel that some of these easy metrics, as you sort of described there, are almost like the crack cocaine of modern marketing.
Yes, yes.
And it's like, once you get started, it's really, really hard to stop.
There is if you like, there's a fantastic, I think there's a guy called Martin Weigel at Wyden and Kennedy in Amsterdam. He's brilliant, account planner over there. And he's done a lovely piece about the kind of crack cocaine of short-term metrics. It's a wonderful analogy, builds and builds and builds on. It's brilliant. So definitely, you should seek that one out.
Perfect, I will do. So that's great. So the final one I wanted to ask you about, and only because it's got a great name, is Bias 18, the pratfall effect. Because anything that's got Pratt in it, I just it. So tell us about the pratfall effect.
This is my favourite bias. I love this bias. It's the idea from a guy called Elliot Aronson, who is professor of psychology at Harvard. And it's the idea that people, and then other people have shown for brands as well, who admit a flaw become more, or exhibit a flaw, become more appealing.
Right.
And again, it's not just speculation. So he's the kind of first classic experiment was kind of goes as follows. He recruits a friend to take part in a quiz, and then he records this guy at the quiz. Aronson has given the contestant the answers. So guy does amazingly, gets 92% of the questions right and wins the quiz by miles. But then as he is standing up to leave, he makes a pratfall. So this is a kind of a small blunder. I think pratfalls are an Americanism for blunder.
Right.
So he makes this blunder. He stands up and spills a cup of coffee down himself.
Right.
So Aronson then takes this recording and he plays it to people. And he plays it in one of two versions. So either people hear the entire incident, mistake, and brilliant performance, or just the brilliant performance. And what Aronson finds is that people, when he asks them how appealing the contestant is, the contestant is seen to be significantly more appealing when you've heard his mistake as well as his great quiz question answering. So he's made to feel more human, more likable, more approachable when he's seen to make a mistake. Now, what's interesting is that finding has been shown outside of this kind of laboratory experiment in terms of brands. There's a study by Northwestern University which has shown amongst product reviews that if a – and this is one a massive sample, 111,000 product reviews. It looked at the score of the product review and then the likelihood of people going on to buy that product. And once a review gets higher than depending on the product category, 4.2 and 4.5 out of 5, if it gets higher than that, likelihood to purchase begins to decline.
Right.
Because the academics argue consumers know there's generally a trade-off in life with goods and therefore it just becomes unbelievable. And it's not that you've persuaded people that there isn't a flaw with your product. You just haven't told them where it is. And if they don't know where it is, the danger is they assume it's somewhere important.
Right.
And then the wonderful thing with this is it's phenomenally... it's been a brilliant springboard for some of the best advertising campaigns in history. So if you think about VW Beetle, ugly skin deep, they admitted it was ugly. Avis in the 60s admitted they were unpopular. You know, we're number two, so we try harder. Listerine, that it tasted awful. You know, the taste you hate twice a day. Marmite, love it or hate it. Guinness, good things come to those who wait. Again and again, the best brands have admitted a weakness.
Yes.
Thereby showing they're honest, thereby making all their other claims more believable. And when the really clever ones have done it, is they haven't just chosen this weakness randomly. They have picked a weakness that has a mirror strength.
Right.
So, you know, Guinness, well, yes, it's a long, slow pour, and yes, that's a bit annoying, but they work on the kind of rule of thumb, well, actually, things that are higher quality generally do take a bit longer.
Sure.
Yeah, there are wonderful use for most of those brands that I mentioned of admitting a weakness so they can make their real strength that much more powerful.
And I think actually, kind of going back to the idea about reviews and things, I think the way that actually kind of plays out, particularly if you think about, you know, travel or this, that, or kind of like sort of, you know, Trustpilot type of reviews or whatever it might be for products and services and stuff. It's true that modern consumers are skeptical when people, when companies... products and services only get positive reviews because, you know, people know that, you know, like there is no necessarily one size fits all, and sometimes life happens and things go wrong. And actually the thing that there is really is important, is people looking at the top end and going, well, okay, that's great. And then they're also starting to look at the bottom end, because actually it's almost an insurance where they look at it and they go, if something goes wrong, what's going to go wrong and how did the company respond?
Yes. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. They think, well, if a hotel's got 100 reviews and they're all 5-star, you think, well, what's more likely, that everyone who's been to this hotel has been perfectly happy, or the company's a bit dodgy and they've been, you know, airbrushing their reviews? And I think they'll probably err on the side of skepticism.
Yes.
And then, as you say, the other bit is people want, you know, look at those poor reviews. Let's say I've got two kids, and let's say the hotel only gets a 4.5 rating. The thing that people complain about is there are too many kids in the restaurant. Well, to me, that's all. Well, I know what its floor is.
Yeah.
Actually, that doesn't matter to me, so absolutely fine.
Absolutely. There's
a, yeah. Yeah, so, I think it's a counterproductive to try and hide your flaws.
And I think that's kind of true. And actually, there's another sort of like, it's not been proven, but no, but also kind of, some people doesn't sometimes get a lot of support, but there's this idea called the service recovery paradox, where actually when you can, let me get this right, you can, if something goes wrong and then you respond well and fix something in a timely and sort of robust kind of way of any problem that customers have, you can actually generate a higher level of satisfaction post problem being solved than if nothing actually had happened at all.
Yeah, yeah. So I'd heard people say that, but I was never sure whether it was true or not. So that's a fascinating one. I mean, I guess it's I think I've heard the Rory Southern argument, maybe, that, you know, this signifies to the user that they are in a long term relationship and they value their customer. They're gonna try and put it right. It's fascinating quirk.
I actually think that there's something kind of deeper. It's a deeper psychological thing in there, which is there's been other sort of neuroscientific sort of research, pieces of research done that says that we value avoiding risk and disappointment and failure between 5 and 17 times more than we do kind of joy, surprise, and delight and things. And because that's all to do with our primal instincts around, we want to avoid these risks because it becomes a threat to our survival. And failures in sort of products and services and things, we equate to kind of threats, as it were, and then if somebody comes and takes away that threat and does it quickly and with experience and things, then actually that we think more of them because they've taken a threat away from us.
Yeah,
that's my kind of like, you know, interpretation of why that might work.
Yeah, no, I think it's fascinating. I mean, as you say, there's a lot of evidence around loss aversion. As you say, for most of our evolutionary history, catastrophic losses were. It was more important to avoid those than, you know, huge gains.
Yes.
Yeah. No. That's very interesting. And also, if you take that on board, you think there's all sorts of things you can do with it, because you can say, well, the important thing for a brand is not to show necessarily that you are the best brand; it's to show that you are not horrendous.
Exactly.
And then suddenly you get into areas like why social proof is so important, the idea that popular brands become more popular still.
Yes.
So showing you are Britain's most popular beer, or you sell 10,000 units a year, that has a value, because people know if it's that popular, it can't go, or it's less likely to go catastrophically wrong.
Absolutely. So Richard, I hope our rummage around those kind of biases has given our listeners and readers a taste of kind of what's in the book, and that they should go and kind of hot foot it to either on the laptop or kind of, you know, down the street to the local bookstore and pick up a copy. But if I was to say to you that, so there's people that are execs or entrepreneurs or leaders listening to this interview, and they're reading the highlights, and they're thinking about some of these highlights and behavioral science, and it's been floating around, and they've been thinking about how to use it and kind of where to, you know, get started, or where to put the spanner, as it were, kind of to start with. I mean, what would you say to them? What would be your piece of advice to say, start here, this is what you should do first?
Yeah. I mean, I think the book is, Choice Factor, is designed to be, you know, very simple and very practical. So I think it is a good place to start. Mm-hmm. I also talk in the book about where else to look. There is a brilliant, I think two brilliant things are probably decoded by Phil Barden. Mm-hmm. Again, it's not just talking about the academic findings, it spends as much time saying how you should apply them. So that's another, that's a great book I'd recommend.
Another former guest of the podcast.
I didn't realize that. And then the second one, which I love because, and this is something I'm getting more interested in, I think I might have a go at an alternative categorization, but there is either a book called Inside the Nudge Unit, mm-hmm. or you can just Google Behavioral Insight Team EAST framework, EAST framework.
Yes, indeed.
And they categorize a lot of biases into four pillars. Make it easy, make it attractive, make it social, make it timely.
Yes.
So they essentially mean, look, don't just focus on logical reasons to buy your product, make it attractive. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of, you know, counterintuitive ways you could do that, like the Pratfall effect. Mm-hmm. They then say, look, and it's not just about the appeal of the product, it's also people ignore how important making something easy is. So be ruthless at taking out barriers to your product. Mm-hmm. Make it social, which is nothing to do with social media. It's all about show that yours is a popular product and lots of people are using it. And then the timely part is a message will have a very different effect dependent on when people encounter it. So I think that you know, looking at that book or that document and getting familiar with the EAST framework, I find that whenever a problem comes in, I basically think, well, how would I, you know, apply those four pillars, and you often come up with a different set of solutions than you might have otherwise. I think it's a very useful approach.
Perfect. I hasten to add, and I'm going to do a little bit of a plug for my own book, because I actually got permission to include the EAST framework in my own book as well.
Ah, excellent. So, well, I think it's a wonderful, simple yet authoritative approach. Brilliant.
I think it's absolutely right. So, Richard, anything that you'd like to add before I ask you my final question?
Yeah. Well, I suppose the only thing would be just to let people know I'm fascinated by this blend of social psychology and advertising. So if people are interested in that, I tweet about that topic at rshotton.
That's kind of rshotton.
That is correct, yeah.
Perfect. So, final question, Richard, and I always ask this question at the end of these interviews, and the question is this. Is there anything that you would like to shamelessly plug?
Oh, well, I've just shamelessly plugged myself once. Well, no, this is, I think the only thing is, look, I hope if people, the Choice Factory, the book I've just written, would be the one thing I would love to plug, because it took a lot of effort and it's a lot of years' work have gone into it. So hopefully people take some of those findings and start applying them to their business and their brand.
Perfect. Richard, that's been super interesting. And I just want to say thank you for your time and sharing your kind of experience with us today. Congratulations on the book. I found it really useful and fascinating, just as a way of almost, it feels like volume one of the 192.
Yeah, I think there will definitely be a volume two. I'm not sure if there'll be, what would it make it, volume six or seven. I think, two volumes probably.
So just want to say, Richard, that's been great. And sort of thank you very much.
Fantastic. Thanks, Adrian.
Well, that's it for another interview. I really hope you enjoyed it. Now, every time I complete one of these interviews, I learn something new. And I try and incorporate that new learning into my writing, my speaking, my workshops, and the consulting that I do for my clients. If you're interested, you can find out more about how I work with clients over at adrianswimsko.com. But one final thing before I go, please consider heading over to iTunes or whichever podcast platform you choose to use, and do leave a review. Every little helps, as they say. Anyway, that's all for now. Thank you for listening, and do listen in again. All the very best.